Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. As the conservative magazine The Weekly Standard writes, it's payback time in Washington for British Prime Minister Tony Blair. Today, Blair pays his first visit to President Bush since his re-election last month, when Blair won but lost seats in Parliament because of his support for the war in Iraq. And one of the things Blair wants in return is more aid to Africa. But he may leave Washington disappointed. Joining us on the line from Washington is Walter Kansteiner. He, during President's first term, was Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. Mr. Kansteiner, welcome.
Thank you.
And we know the two leaders are going to meet later today, but we already know that both will agree to a joint initiative for famine relief, towards which the U.S. will put $674 million. That's already being criticized because it's not new money, which Tony Blair is asking for. Your thoughts, should the U.S. be doing more?
Well, I think we should always be doing more. I'm an advocate for Africa, and so I will always be supportive of seeing more assistance going to Africa if it's directed in the right and effective way.
And what would the reason be for the President Bush turning down Tony Blair's request for more money?
Well, what Tony Blair is trying to do is an interesting idea. It's called the IFI, which is an international lending facility that would basically go out into the capital markets, borrow money on future development assistance, and front-end load that into Africa right now. So in other words, all the G7 countries would be saying, we're willing to borrow money in the future, go ahead and give Africa the money now, and let's stand Africa up. President Bush is saying, well, I'm not so sure that's a great idea. Number one, can we really commit future Congresses to this new debt? And number two, can Africa absorb this new money that's going to be coming flooding in?
Is there a number three, which is the Bush administration worries about countries that have corrupt or inept officials, that he wants to target countries that can handle the money?
Well, good point. In fact, that's exactly what the Bush administration's policy has been through what they call their Millennium Challenge Corporation, which picks the top-performing countries, both from a governmental and political point of view, as well as a point of view of delivering services to their people, that is housing and education, pick those six or seven or eight top countries in Africa and really build on those, let those kind of be the core centers, and demonstrate that those countries that are making the right policy choices can actually be stood up and have a viable fighting chance to make it.
Well, and as you know, Tony Blair and others have a different kind of thinking. Tony Blair's thinking, as it's been characterized, rich nations have an obligation to poorer nations, not just poorer nations who are well-run. And aid workers in Africa criticize the Millennium Challenge account the president set up 3 years ago. They say the money comes with too many strings attached, such as proof of efforts to end corruption. And so far, we read that only eight countries have qualified for aid, and only one, Madagascar, has finalized a deal to receive aid. So is that working fast enough when there are people starving in Africa?
Well, I think that, you know, you gotta look at it as two channels. One is long-term infrastructure capability of really being a performing economy. And six or seven or eight countries in Africa are most likely on that path, and that's who Millennium Challenge Account has selected. The other development assistance is really things like famine relief, health care, HIV/AIDS, antiretroviral medicines. That is the immediate response to a humanitarian crisis that's either happening or about to happen. And so the Bush administration is trying to blend both of those. Yes, we've got to react to the events on the ground and the severe poverty and the severe crises that are occurring, but also let's look a little bit beyond the horizon and try to start building some real success stories on this continent.
Well, Walter Kansteiner, before we let you go, Tony Blair is also proposing to eliminate African debt. He told reporters he's hoping he'll come to an agreement with President Bush in the seconds we have. How likely is it, you've worked in this administration, how likely is it they'll agree to forgive the debt?
You know, I think both sides want to do debt forgiveness. It's now the question of how you do it. Do you just write it off the books of the World Bank and the IMF and the multilaterals, or does someone actually have to pay that debt back? And that's what they're debating. But both of them want to see the debt go away.
Walter Kansteiner is a founding principal of the Scowcroft Group in Washington, D.C. He was Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs during President Bush's first term. Walter, thank you for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Take care.
An auditor who had gone public with charges of fraud and waste at Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico was beat up this weekend by unknown assailants, and he says he was told that if he knew what was good for him, he'd keep his mouth shut. This month, that auditor, Tommy Hook, was scheduled to testify before Congress about alleged spending irregularities at the lab. Hook and his partner, Chuck Montano, say they uncovered financial misdoings in the procurement or purchasing division at Los Alamos. Well, we're joined now by Chuck Montano. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you for having us.
And also by Robert Rothstein, legal counsel to Tommy Hook and Mr. Montano. Welcome to you as well.
Hello, Robin.
And I want to start with you, Mr. Rothstein. Can you tell us first about this attack? How is Tommy Hook?
Well, we haven't heard any medical reports this morning. We did understand that he did sleep some last night. He appears to have a broken jaw. He has other facial fractures. He has quite a few lacerations and bruises. He has a herniated disc in his neck, and he's generally pretty miserable.
Now, this assault was witnessed. There were witnesses to the fact that he was beaten. Take us through this. What happened just before the assault? We understand Tommy Hook got a mysterious phone call last week on Thursday.
He had talked to me several times during the week and told me that he had been contacted by another auditor from the Los Alamos National Lab administration who had told him that he had important information that would be helpful to Tommy in his preparation for testimony before Congress that it had to do with misuse of funds and wrongdoing. Tommy had made several efforts to meet with this individual, and the person had failed to show up. Saturday night, late at night, Mr. Hook was in bed. He received a call from a person he believed to be the same individual, apologizing for having failed to show up for the prior meetings, and saying that he was willing to meet with him that night in Santa Fe, specified a location at a bar where he wanted to meet, to be in some very out-of-the-way place. Tommy got dressed, went down to Santa Fe, went to the bar, arrived there probably, we estimate, around 11:30, waited around for approximately an hour. Nobody showed up. He left the bar, went out, got in his car, started the car up, and was preparing to drive away when he was jumped by four or five individuals who dragged him out of the car, kicked and beat him, and made some of the comments that you've mentioned, threatening him, telling him to keep his mouth shut if he knew what was good for him.
This is all on Saturday night. We should say that he alerted you that he was having these phone interactions. He also called representatives from POGO, the Project on Government Oversight, and told them as well before the meetings. Because, as you know, some would say, gee, a man is found in a fight outside the Cheeks nightclub at 2 a.m., late Saturday night, early Sunday morning. It's a strip joint. Some would say, well, he's just a guy who was at a strip joint. And so he made up a story to deflect attention from the fact he was at a strip joint. But you're saying that he says he received a call to go to that strip joint.
Yes, those of you, us who know Tommy, and Chuck can probably talk about this better than I can, know that he's not the type of individual who goes to bars. He's a very quiet homebody. He's had some pretty severe health problems. He's not the type of person who hangs out at bars or frequents bars and but for somebody inviting him to this be the location, he would not have been there.
Well, in fact, Chuck Montano, tell us, has anyone spoken to the other auditor at Los Alamos who was supposed to show up that Friday night and who Tommy thought called him again on Saturday night to find out where he was?
Well, I don't know if this auditor really exists or if this was somebody that was posing as someone having information to try to coax Tommy. Now I'm beginning to wonder if that may have been the case. Tommy had been keeping me informed as well, telling me that somebody had contacted him, indicating they had some important information that would be useful in our case.
Well, then, Mr. Montano, I want to stop you there. Tell us about your case. What do you and Tommy Hook claim, what irregularities do you claim to have found at Los Alamos?
I think the fundamental problem is that when, we're trained auditors and investigators, And when we do our job and we actually find some serious problems or weaknesses, then we become targeted for retaliation if we don't want to cover up the problems. And I think that's the pattern that we have here with Los Alamos National Lab and the University of California.
You made these irregularities known to your supervisors at the lab, and what happened to you?
Yes. Well, we, you know, we obviously we were hired to do the assessment of the procurement area. The laboratory had been informing Congress and the general public that all the problems that had been uncovered during the Walp and Doran affair a couple of years earlier, where procurement fraud was found, had been taken care of. What we did is we did our assessment of the procurement function, and we found that they still had a lot of problems. We uncovered a lot of questionable, millions of dollars in questionable and unallowable costs. What the lab was conveying to Congress and to the general public, which was that everything had been taken care of, our assessments found that wasn't the case. That was far from the case. When we were instructed to basically cover up the problem, to report differently from what we had uncovered, we refused to do that. We refused to be part of any cover-up attempt. That's when we then began to experience retaliation.
You claim that the labs tried to get you to quit your jobs, and so you filed a whistleblower retaliation lawsuit.
Tommy Hook is very important because he was the lab's former whistleblower officer. He was the person for the laboratory that people would call if they had anything to report related to fraud, waste, and abuse. He lost that position because of testimony that he gave in the 1995 layoff, in which one of the individuals laid off at the lab was one of his auditors, who claimed that the laboratory was trying to prevent him from issuing any reports that might be embarrassing to the University of California. Tommy Hook is a person of integrity. He cannot lie. He'll tell the truth. When he was subpoenaed and deposed in that trial, he told the truth, and he acknowledged that he was being instructed by high-level officials at the lab not to have any audits come out that would be embarrassing to the University of California or that might create an unallowable cost for the University of California. Soon after that testimony, he got removed from his position as the whistleblower officer for the laboratory, and since then his career has been on a downward spiral.
Well, a spokesperson from the lab told Associated Press that the beating of Tommy Hook on Saturday night was a senseless and brutal act, shouldn't be tolerated. The University of California, which runs the Los Alamos lab, also released a statement saying it believes any form of physical violence towards an individual is unacceptable.
Could I respond
yes.
to that real quickly? You know, I've been at the lab 27 years, and those words ring hollow to those of us who have been there for decades. The fact of the matter is the University of California, who runs the laboratory, condones whistleblower abuse. They fight.
But this was a beating, Mr. Montaglio. Are you saying that they would condone that?
What they condone, the problem is that when an institution doesn't resolve the problem and turns the whistleblower into the problem and will resist and resist that whistleblower for years and years of senseless litigation, what you're doing is you're putting that whistleblower out there as a target. And over time, as emotions build, things like this can happen. So that's where I really don't sympathize much with the university's statement that they don't tolerate this. What they should not be tolerating is any kind of whistleblower abuses that are occurring, and these kind of abuses occur regularly.
That's Chuck Montagno with Tommy Hook. He filed a whistleblower retaliation lawsuit against the University of California, which runs Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico. They are both waiting to testify before Congress. We also spoke with Robert Rothstein, attorney for both men. The FBI, along with Santa Fe Police, are investigating this past weekend's assault on Tommy Hook. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we've been talking whistleblowers today. And, of course, the most famous in American history blew his own 30-year cover last week. Deep Throat was not technically a whistleblower in that his identity was secret. He didn't get any of the heat whistleblowers get until he, former FBI man W. Mark Felt, revealed his part in uncovering the Watergate scandal. But how did today's whistleblowers feel when they saw Mark Felt emerge from the shadow to praise from some people and condemnation from others? Joining us now, Colleen Rowley, the FBI agent who wrote a memo to FBI Director Robert Mueller saying the agency brushed off her bureau's concerns before 9/11 about a certain Zacharias Moussaoui, who's since pled guilty to conspiracy in the events of 9/11. Colleen, thanks for joining us.
Yes, thank you for having me.
We're also joined by Sharon Watkins, the Enron vice president who warned Chairman Kenneth Lay that the company's accounting was improper, and she joins us as well from Houston, Texas.
Thanks.
Glad to speak to you as well. And I want to ask you first, Sharon, because we just heard before the break about Tommy Hook, the Los Alamos auditor, who was beaten this past weekend, and he says warned to stop blowing the whistle on fraud and overbilling at that research facility. Sharon, when I think of overbilling, I think of you. There was a lot at stake at Enron when you spoke up. Did you ever worry about your personal safety?
Well, the only thing that concerned me was when the various executives at Enron were trying to convince me that I was all wet. That I was the only person that thought the company had committed accounting fraud, and I would worry sometimes that, well, if you know, street white collar criminals rarely resort to street crime, but as you say, they were powerful people with a lot at stake, and when I thought that they thought I was the only person that considered this fraud, I considered myself more at risk. But once the company had folded, had declared bankruptcy, and once Congress released my memos to the press, I actually felt much safer.
Mm. And Colleen Rowley, nothing's more deeply and profoundly personal to Americans now than their safety post 9/11 and hearing that the government potentially knew of one of the hijackers could have investigated him prior to 9/11 and that your office in Minneapolis was begging them to do so. There's a lot at stake there in that charge. Did you ever worry about your safety?
Well, because the people would have been probably FBI personnel, and I do have a high respect for most of the FBI personnel that I worked with over the years. I did not ever think of anyone in the FBI, you know, at least that was still working in the FBI, doing anything to me. Another thing, though, is with the publicity and the notoriety. There are people out there who kind of mentally challenge people. When you're known and where you live and now you're in on covers and stuff, there's always that problem and that issue.
Do you feel that?
I think in the case of Mark Felt, that was entirely, he could have had the very valid fears about this group of people retaliating. If you think about it, they ordered burglaries. And, of course, what's the next level here? They're willing to commit very highly illegal actions. So I think a person in Mark Felt's situation could have been very concerned that their physical safety was at risk.
Yeah. Well, both of you, along with Cynthia Cooper from WorldCom, were named Time Magazine's Persons of the Year in 2002 for daring to step forward with very serious allegations in your individual organizations. What were your reactions when you saw Deep Throat step forward after 30 years? And, Sharon, let's start with you. Had you already in some way identified with him?
Well, I could certainly identify with sort of the angst you feel when your motives are questioned back and forth across a you know, highly visible media landscape.
As yours were.
Well, I think initially the Enron story had so many villains, I was lauded as a hero. However, it's a bit ironic. I've been criticized for just blowing the whistle inside the corporation, in effect not blowing it outside at all, just meeting with the CEO of Enron. I've been criticized for not going to the press, and Mark Felt has been criticized for exactly that action, for taking it to the press and not going up the chain of command.
Yeah. Let's remind ourselves more about your story. I'm Sharon Watkins, again, the Enron vice president. You warned Chair Kenneth Lay that there was trouble at the company, but you didn't initially, in fact, both of you didn't set out to be whistleblowers. You wrote a private memo.
That's right, and both of us were exposed from the outside. We didn't make our concerns public. But I see the Deep Throat situation as one of little choice but to go to the press. The press is last resort. I don't think he really could work up the chain of command
in the
FBI. He was so close to the top,
yeah.
And it seemed like his boss was potentially in on some of the problems.
Well, back to Colleen Rowley from the FBI. And on another note, you both have said you hate the word whistleblower. Why? Some would think you'd embrace it, be proud of it.
Yeah, you know what I think this is? To some extent, we have difficulty seeing when loyalty goes bad. I think there's a great quote. I don't know if I have time to get it through, but on the walls of J. Edgar Hoover's FBI, so for over 40 years, there was a quote on the walls that all of the personnel like Mark Felt would have seen every day. And the quote went like this: "If you work for a man in heaven's name, work for him, speak well of him, and stand by the institution he represents. An ounce of loyalty is worth a pound of cleverness. If you must growl, condemn, and eternally find fault, resign your position. And when you are on the outside, damn to your heart's content. But as long as you are part of the institution, do not condemn it. For if you do, the first high wind that comes along may blow you away, and you may never know why. Now, that's a kind of an odd quote to be on the walls of a federal agency that is supposed to serve the public and is sworn to uphold the Constitution. And I think this is where all of it gets quite confused in the minds of people who say, he wasn't loyal. Mark Felt was not loyal. He was loyal, but he was loyal to a higher principle than to the president that he was serving.
Well, in the time that we have, we really appreciate your spending it with us. Sharon Watkins, formerly of Enron, Colleen Rowley, formerly of the FBI. Thanks for speaking with us, both of you.
Sure, you're quite welcome.
Okay, bye.
Stay with us. More ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Recently, the waters off New England have seen an explosion of tiny red organisms called Alexandrium, more sinister sounding when you call them by their common name, red tide. The cloud of single-celled phytoplankton has spread down from the coast of Maine beyond Cape Cod, the most wide-reaching red tide bloom on record, closing shellfish beds wherever it goes. Dr. Don Anderson is a senior scientist at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute on Cape Cod. Here Knows Bob Oakes reached Dr. Anderson in Paris, where he's attending an international conference dealing with algae blooms, such as red tide.
Dr. Anderson, can you tell us first off exactly what red tide is?
Well, the answer to that depends a bit on where in the country or the world you are. If you're down in Florida, for example, red tide might mean the water is red and there's floating fish, dead fish, and maybe even an aerosolized toxin that makes it difficult to breathe. In the New England area, the red tide means something quite different, namely that the shellfish have become contaminated with a toxin that can make it very dangerous to humans and other animals who might eat those shellfish.
What causes outbreaks of this algae?
In this region, the problems originate from the dormant or resting stages of this particular organism. The bottom of the Gulf of Maine in many locations is sort of carpeted with these cysts or seeds that are dormant, and then they will germinate at certain times of the year, and then they will produce a cell that can become a little plant. It photosynthesizes, it divides, it becomes more numerous, and each of those cells becomes more numerous, and that's how you can ultimately, if you have enough, either change the color of the water because of their pigments, or have enough that when they are consumed by the shellfish, a toxic situation ensues.
How does this affect humans?
The symptoms for a human that has consumed some of this toxin would start typically with a tingling of the fingertips and the lips, for example, and then it would progress to difficulties in breathing and orienting oneself, and ultimately to an inability to breathe, and that's ultimately what can cause death.
What could cause this year's outbreak in the waters off New England to be the worst in 30 plus years, as this outbreak is described?
We're looking at a number of factors to try to explain that, and probably the biggest one right now that we're looking at is the amount of fresh water that is found in the coastal waters of the Gulf of Maine. This was a winter where we had a tremendous amount of snow. We also had a spring, and especially a May that was just raining all the time. And all that water runs off the land and into the ocean, and it can do several things.
And one is that it makes this very special transport pathway along the coast. The water is slightly buoyant compared to seawater. It travels along the coast and near shore, and it contains a lot of the nutrients and other materials that these particular cells really like to live on.
Any way to predict how far south this particular outbreak might move down to Martha's Vineyard now and headed south?
One of the problems we're having with this outbreak is that it keeps exceeding our experience. It is reaching areas and spreading further than we've ever seen, so it's very difficult to make predictions based on any prior experience.
What's the huge bloom this year mean for future years? Is there anything that can be predicted?
One of the things we're very concerned about with this bloom is that it might change the pattern of these blooms in future years. We've always felt, and it's certainly again true this year, that the problems we have down in Massachusetts and Massachusetts Bay and Cape Cod largely are transported to these waters from the north, with these cells that originate in the Bay of Fundy or near the Penobscot Bay area and travel down in these coastal currents. Now that there are so many cells within the bay and within Cape Cod Bay, we know that they are starting to produce these resting stages, these cysts that will fall to bottom sediments and then remain there as a seed population for future blooms. So it is possible that we will change that paradigm of how the blooms occur in this region and find that the area can become its own source, a sort of a self-seeding, self-propagating area that will have more toxicity in a different way than we've seen in the past.
Is there any research being done on how to combat this by killing off the organisms?
The whole idea of mitigating or suppressing a red tide bloom is one that a number of labs are working on. My lab is doing that as well for some of these red tides in different parts of the world. It's a highly controversial line of research. You know, we catch a lot of flack from both our colleagues and from some environmental groups because many of them feel that you whatever you're doing might be worse than the problem itself. But that being said, the research is still ongoing. There are some strategies. Unfortunately, though, these are all still at the research stage and are probably 5 or 10 years or more from any application in the field.
Dr. Anderson, thank you very much.
Okay, you're very welcome.
Dr. Don Anderson is a senior scientist at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution on Cape Cod. He spoke with Here and Now's Bob Oakes. Well, for a quick check on how red tide is affecting the economy, let's turn to McGregor Hay. He's co-owner of Max Seafood in Wellfleet, Massachusetts on the Cape. And Mac, how has red tide affected your business?
Red tide has had a fairly large impact already. It's only been about 2 weeks that it's affected the Cape Cod Bay. But people are just very wary of buying shellfish that isn't from here, and also other products that are still native to the area.
Right, and it is hard to get shellfish that is from here. I mean, we're hearing from one listener wrote to say that he's a clammer, and he says, you know, the steamers just aren't coming in from off the Monomoy Islands. And we understand you're importing shellfish from other locations.
Yes, we have Malpec oysters coming from some areas in Canada, as well as some James River oysters coming from Virginia, but it's just not the same product at all. And as far as the steamers go, they're very scarce. Prices are pretty much double what they normally are at this time of year, which affects the fried clam.
Right. And do people, in the few seconds we have, we've got the Wellfleet oysters here on Cape Cod, very proud of them here in the New England area. You're getting other oysters from other areas. Do customers know the difference?
Oh, absolutely. Well, first of all, we would never sell anything under the guise of the Wellfleet oyster because it just, well, for one thing, it's illegal, and secondly, it doesn't do it any justice. But the Wellfleet oyster has a reputation because it is such a particular oyster. Its flavor is unique, and this community thrives on,
right.
on
how
that
many,
product.
How many have you got left?
We actually sold all of our Wellfleets last night.
Okay.
We have no Wellfleet oysters left, and we're hoping that this bloom, this red tide, this black cloud that's over us leaves soon.
And you can recoup some of your losses. Mac Hay, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
We're hoping along with you.
All right.
Mac Hay, co-owner of Max Seafood and Wellfleet on Cape Cod. And we'll keep an eye on that red tide and hope it goes away. Still to come, from Princess Leia to Luke Skywalker, One guest can do them all. Who needs to see the movie? You're listening to Here and Now. Time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts. Earlier this week, we discussed the Amnesty International report on human rights abuses around the world. Critics and supporters of the report both questioned the use of the word gulag to describe the U.S. detention facility at Guantanamo Bay. And I asked Josh Rubenstein of Amnesty International if it was a mistake to use that loaded word. Well, we heard from many of you. Paul Millman of Westminster, Vermont, objected to the question. Do you really need to be sidetracked by some rhetoric when the reality is so horrid, he writes? Do you really contend that the hyperbolic use of some word is more significant than the reality of life for prisoners at Guantanamo? But Rudy Borkowski of Brookline, Massachusetts, wrote, personally, I'm not a great lover of the present administration and Congress, but I thought you adeptly held Amnesty International's feet to the fire. This goes a long way to helping us listeners get a better view on the topic, besides useless sound bites out of either Amnesty International or the White House. We also had response to the interview with Commander Glenn Solmacy, a professor at the U.S. Coast Guard Academy. He argued that initial reaction by the U.S. to terrorism was appropriate, because after 9/11, the U.S. was in a new kind of war. He added the rules should probably be readdressed now. Well, that response to the Amnesty report moved Melody Evans of Amana, Iowa, to write, Glenn Solmacy convinced me that Amnesty must be correct because his argument was so impossible to sustain. We are not in a new type of war. This is a created overreaction that shows this country is neither special nor better than any other country. And Dick DeSave of Gilmanton, New Hampshire, writes, I respectively dispute Commander Solmacy's contention that it is against U.S. policy to use torture at our foreign and domestic prisons. In fact, it is U.S. policy to use torture, as shown in memos from Donald Rumsfeld and Attorney General Gonzalez. In addition, when the type of torture needed isn't readily available at U.S. prisons, we simply fly those prisoners to totalitarian nations who do the torture for us. I applaud Amnesty International's courage in using the term gulag. This is where we are headed, and it is appropriately descriptive of what we are doing in the falsely termed war on terror. Well, moving on. Yesterday, we reported on the move by several suburban Pop Warner football teams here in the Boston area to pull out of the league rather than play inner-city teams, citing issues of safety. We spoke to Jonathan Gates, head of the football program for Pop Warner Mattapan in urban Boston. He said working through issues of racism was part of the game. That didn't sit well with Betsy Porter of Minneapolis, Minnesota. She writes, the Pop Warner coach deflected and ridiculed all of the concerns raised and refused to take any responsibility. Who can blame parents for not wanting their kids to play where they feel unsafe? He should bench any kid who uses hate speech and not try to deflect it as part of the game. Well, we spoke recently about retirement plans and asked, why don't more people join 401k savings plans, especially when employers match employee contributions? Listener John had one answer. He writes, I have not joined my small company's 401k plan, and I did not for the following reasons. None of the mutual funds in the plan are making any money, but you can't tell this by any of the information they supply in the huge folder they hand out when they have an info session. The facts and figures in the folders are usually 1 or even 2 years old. I went to the internet and researched each fund. I took a poll at work, and not 1 in 10 could tell me the names of even one fund in the plan, or even if they were making any money. I'm still looking for a way to save and invest for my retirement. Finally, we spent some time yesterday with comic Jonathan Katz, who had been diagnosed with MS and is trying to find humor in the debilitating disease. We heard from Sylvia Rothschild, whose daughter was also diagnosed with MS 15 years ago. She enjoyed the piece, but at times found it difficult.
She was one of the funniest people I have ever met. It was always fun. And when she first got it, we laughed and we tried to make jokes about it. She is now in a nursing home, completely quadriplegic, cannot move, just move her head a little. She was the most vivacious, gregarious person, just like this person. And I felt bad for him because it could happen. She's one of the 15%. She doesn't even have any hope of ever being better.
As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town. Stay with us. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Hang on to your lightsabers. The Revenge of the Sith isn't the only new Star Wars show in town. A new version of the original trilogy is coming to a stage not so far, far away. It's a one-man show starring Charlie Ross, who in 58 minutes, without a break, channels everyone from Princess Leia to Jabba the Hutt, flinging himself through space and time, producing music and the special effects with just one instrument, his voice. The show makes its off-Broadway debut in New York in August, but we spoke to Charlie from the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio in Milwaukee, where he was on tour. He told me he'd watched the films more than 400 times as a kid, and one scene in particular served as the inspiration for his one-man space opera.
In Return of the Jedi, C-3PO, the golden droid, he tells the story of sort of all the films up to the point where they're at in the third film to a bunch of Ewoks. So he's speaking in another language, and he's using sound effects and just sort of acting little things out, miming stuff.
But the Cloud City.
I don't know. He just does something weird in the actual show.
But how would you distill the show?
You kind of just do it off the top of your head. Try to tell it using nothing more than the lines from the films and the sound effects, and you just sort of try to piece stuff together in a rather bizarre kind of way. It's almost like a collage, but a breathing, sweating, geeky collage on stage, you know, and people seem to follow it pretty well.
They come to you to get the Cliff Notes.
Well, kind of, yeah. I'm from Canada. We have our Coles Notes, but, you know, it's basically the condensed version, the sort of concentrated orange juice version of the Star Wars trilogy.
Charlie Ross, could you do us the favor of first setting it up for us, let us know what mm-hmm. we're going to hear, and then give us an idea of a part of this performance.
You bet, you bet. This here is the trash compactor scene from the very first film, the 77 release of A New Hope. And, of course, that would be Han Solo, Princess Leia, Luke, Chewbacca, C-3PO, and R2-D2. And, of course, the garbage monster.
Get behind me! Get behind me! This is some rescue. You got in here just for the plan for getting out? Well, he's the brain, sweetheart. What the hell are you doing? Some has to save us, kids. In the garbage chute, flyboy. Get in there, you big woolly oaf. I don't care what you smell. Get in there. Get in there. Wonderful girl. I'm going to kill her. I'm beginning to like her. Get in there. Ah, the garbage chute. What a wonderful idea. What an incredible smell you've discovered.
Well, it could be worse.
It's worse. There's something alive in here. Somebody just swam past my leg. Look, did you see that? Kid, Luke! Kid, Luke! Blast it, will you? Had my gun jammed. Where? Oh, anywhere. No. Kid, Luke! Kid, Luke!
Grab him! What happened?
I don't know. Just let go of me and disappeared. The walls are closing in. Don't just stand there. Try to brace him with something. Wait a minute. 3PO? Come here, 3PO! 3PO! Oh, where could he be? 3PO! 3PO! Are you there, sir? 3PO! We've had some problems. Will you shut up and listen to me? Shut down all the garbage smashes on the detention level. Do you copy? Shut down all the garbage smashes on the detention level. No, shut them all down. Hurry. Hey, you dead 3PO! Oh, listen to them, R2. They're dying. Oh, curse my metal body. It wasn't fast enough. It's all my fault. My fault. We're all right. You did great.
And it just goes on and on and on for 58 minutes. Yeah. Of course. course, you can throw in some sweat and, yeah, a lot of geekdom.
It's well, good. I want to ask, since this is radio, how do you distinguish, you know, for instance, Princess Leia from, you know, Chewbacca? I mean, obviously there's sound, but do you do something physically?
Yeah, I guess it comes down to body posture. Sometimes it's little tiny things. In the case of Princess Leia, in the first film, she had those cinnamon buns on the side of her head. So I mime those on the side of my head and kind of make it look like she's got big, giant car door ears.
With your hands, you mean?
Yeah, just with my hands. I don't know. I could have gone with the costumes and the set and, you know, lightsabers and stuff. But frankly, I think it would be just a little bit lame. It's almost like a bonsai tree. You know, it's really, really pared down.
By the way, Chewbacca. Did I hear Chewbacca in there?
yeah, you did. You heard him.
What does this feel like when you're doing it? 58 minutes. I know you're sweating like a pig when you're done.
It's strange. I mean, doing any one-person show, you know, you're obviously lacking another on-stage character. With this type of sort of, not just the genre, but the show itself, it already has this huge following of fans. And they are really some of the most devoted, intense fans you'll ever come across. So to do this type of show, it's like the most amazing sort of on-stage partner you could have. They remember the weird little idiosyncrasies of the films and of the characters, and you just try to keep in the moment as best as you can. And, you know, I do the one-man Lord of the Rings as well.
Well, we understand that. Could we just, I mean, could we hear a little bit of Gollum as long as we're there?
Oh, you bet. We wants it. We needs it. Must have the precious. Master is our friend. You don't have any friends. Nobody likes you. I'm not listening. You're a liar and a thief. Nope. Murderer. I hate you. Where is with me? Ellum. It was me. We survived because of me. Not anymore.
Charlie Ross, how do you do this? That's three Tolkien books in a one-hour show, and then the Star Wars trilogy in 58 minutes. How do you do it? How do you figure out what stays, what goes?
Well, I don't know. You have to be economical. You have to edit. You have to just sort of make an executive decision. So if you even, like, cut one character, it's not a matter of just cutting that particular scene. You end up cutting so much stuff down the road, down the rest of the script.
Well, now in August, you've got an off-Broadway debut. George Lucas is a fan of your show. He's invited you to perform it at an ultra-geek festival.
Yeah, I already did that.
And now we've got Episode 3, Revenge of the Sith. Mm-hmm. Are you going to try to work that in by August?
I don't know. I really wonder as to the fan base for it. I know that some of these new Star Wars films haven't been as popular as perhaps the older ones, although I will definitely say that this last one here is fantastic. I really, really enjoyed it.
What is it about this Star Wars story that's so compelling to you?
The neat thing about the Anakin Skywalker story is that it's the ultimate redemption, in a sense. You can be a really good person. You can sort of fall into hard times and maybe be a bad person morally, but in the end, there is some sort of redemption. You can come back.
Can we have a little Darth Vader?
Oh, you sure can. Here. Okay.
You are beaten. It is useless to resist. Don't make me destroy you. Obi-Wan never told you what happened to your father.
He told me enough. He told me you killed him.
No. I am your father.
No. That's not true. That's impossible!
Search your feelings. You know it to be true.
No! No!
You can destroy the Emperor. He has foreseen this. Come with me, and together we'll rule the galaxy as father and son. Come with me. It is the only way.
Charlie Ross and his one-man Star Wars trilogy currently on tour. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org. And the Force is obviously already with you.
Oh, something's with me. I'm not sure what it is.
Charlie spoke to us from the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio in Milwaukee. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Yang. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.